Hello.
Ah, great. The Amos Trust, which is who I work for, is very privileged and proud to have a very special guest to speak today. But before I introduce our guest, I just want to also, many of you who are here will be interested in issues of social justice, and particularly South Africa, due to where our guest comes from. So I just want to plug one or two other things that the Amos Trust is also doing this weekend. Firstly, Eddie Daniels, who's speaking today, will be having an interview tomorrow in this same tent. I'll be interviewing him. That's at 1 p.m. tomorrow in Snog. Eddie Daniels also has a book called Robben Island, There and Back, 1964 to 79. This is available in the bookshop here, and there'll be a signing at 6 o'clock today after this seminar. And I'm sure after you've heard Eddie speak, you will all be rushing there to buy the book. Also, myself and my wife, Mandy, will be giving a talk tomorrow in the Sovereign Lounge at 4:45 about South Africa, and particularly the issue of street children. So that's at 4:45 tomorrow. And another thing I just want to plug is at 8 p.m. tomorrow night in the CMS tent, there is a South African dance and song troupe who've been performing in the West End called Umoja. That's the name of the musical they're in. And they are well worth seeing in terms of South African music and dance. Very cultural. Fantastic. I saw them this week. Paid to go to the West End, not knowing they were coming to Greenbelt. South Africa is a country with a painful history of colonialism and apartheid. Yet today, just 8 years after the end of apartheid, South Africa faces the legacies of that time and the new challenges it has with a democratically elected leadership, the ANC. The struggle against apartheid was a tough and long one to which many gave their lives. There were many heroes. Today we're very privileged to have with us one such hero. He was imprisoned on Robben Island for 15 years with the likes of Nelson Mandela, Walter Sisulu, Governor Mbeki, Ahmed Kathrada and others for blowing up government property. He has an amazing story to tell. Mr. Nelson Mandela refers to him as one of his greatest friends. Ladies and gentlemen, the Amos Trust is proud to welcome with you a selfless champion of the struggle against apartheid, Mr. Eddie Daniels.
Can you leave it? Okay.
Can we take this off or?
Okay.
There we go.
Thank you very much. Good afternoon, everybody. It's a real privilege to be here. I'm indebted to Amos Trust for the invitation, enabling me to be here. I did not realize it would be such an event. Nor did I realize I would meet such lovely people as yourselves. And I am really, really pleased. I would also take this opportunity of complimenting the members of Amos Trust. I found them to be people of caliber and people of integrity. I was impressed immensely by their courage in which they tackle international problems. They uphold and defend human rights throughout the world. And I really think they are a great organization. Thank you. I personally come from a poor background. But most people in South Africa who were black, are black, and who were born in a township like I was, they all come from poor backgrounds. Tom here said, I'm a hero of the struggle. I'm not. I'm just one of the many who made a small contribution. And like the drops in the ocean makes a mighty ocean, and sands on the beach make a mighty beach. I'm just one of those little sands and little drops of ocean, drops of water. I came at the end of the struggle. I was fortunate to see the end of apartheid. I did not think I would see the end of apartheid. When I went to Robben Island, I did not think I would survive. I was fortunate I did. Many others did not. So I am really building on the contributions made by my ancestors. My ancestors fought over the generations, eventually to the stage where I picked up the cudgels, and I, in my small way, made a small contribution, and I was lucky to see the end of apartheid. But I would like to emphasize, ladies and gentlemen, that we, in the freedom struggle, could never have overcome, not never, but it would have taken a long time to overcome the nationalist government on your own. It is the world who assisted us. It is the world who helped bring the struggle against apartheid so much sooner to a close. I wish to thank the whole world for their contributions, which includes you, includes your parents, includes your organizations, includes your governments. We've had so much support throughout the world, and they helped us to defeat apartheid. If nothing else that we saved in South Africa, we saved our infrastructure. Without you, over the next few generations, we'll still be fighting, and in the process, we will destroy the infrastructure and really impoverished my country, South Africa. Because I had a very poor education, standard 6, grade 8, and in my time, in my environment, it was a big deal, standard 6. Ooh. My mother was so proud of me. She hugged me and says, "My boy," he says, "now you can take up an apprenticeship," which I could not do, of course. And nevertheless, because of my poor education, I did menial jobs, factory worker, messenger, delivering things, fishermen, whalemen, diamond mines. And on the diamond mines in Namibia, I discovered a beautiful diamond, really marvelous diamond. And I've been fortunate, very fortunate in discovering that particular diamond. Going on the whalers was an ambition. I wanted to go to the Antarctic. I was impressed by the books I'd read. So exciting going to the Antarctic. And to be able to go to the Antarctic, I had to have sea experience. I then threw up my job at the factory and I worked on the fishing trawlers, one of my most hardest jobs ever. And after 8 months, I had sea experience and I was accepted to go on the Willem Barents. Willem Barents the first in 1953, go to the Antarctic. It was a great experience. I enjoyed it, but I'm afraid the whales did not. It was very cruel on the whales, very cruel death. And I found the whale, especially the blue whale, really a beautiful animal. An animal which, in spite of his mammoth size, where a foot was measured as a ton, and we shot whales 95 feet, 100 feet, means 100 ton. In spite of their huge, huge, huge bulk, they lived on plankton and they lived on shrimp. And I always marvel at nature, with all its mysteries and its enchantment. From the whalers, I went to Namibia and then worked in the diamond mines. Then I came back to South Africa. I joined the Liberal Party of South Africa. It was the only non-racial organization in South Africa at the time. There were lots of protests going on, and I supported all protests against the government. Whether it was prayer meetings, whether it was marches, whether it was sitting down the road, whether it was invading white-only tea rooms, whatever, and in the process we got arrested and beaten up and so on. It was a great day that I joined the Liberal Party of South Africa. There I met people of integrity, people of courage, people I was proud to be with. And I felt uplifted by these people who were so dedicated to fighting injustices. People who risked their all to assist their fellow human beings. And today I look back with fond memories to that organization. In 1968, when I was in prison, the Liberal Party dissolved because the Nationalist government had passed a law which forbade whites and blacks from belonging to the same organization. The Liberal Party felt that they could not live under such a law, and they dissolved. And in prison, when I was challenged by people who were anti-white, because I'm a non-racialist, that I had no longer an organization which was non-racial, I pointed out to them that the Liberal Party could not function under such a law, and therefore I represent the law, the Liberal Party, and I represent them underground. But being a member of the Liberal Party meant I had to comply with extra-parliamentary pressures on the government or activities. It also meant that it was a non-violent movement. And a few of us got together, and we felt that we are not making much progress against this apartheid government. Suffering is just continuing. Suffering is perhaps being intensified. And we felt that we have to do something more, perhaps militant, because all our demonstrations, all our peaceful activities, we were either banned or we were arrested or beaten up, whatever. So a few of us decided to form an organization called the African Resistance Movement, the ARM. And this organization, our policies were, one, we were going to attack government installations, and two, we were going to avoid injuring or killing people through our activities. These were our two big principles. And we attacked government installations. We blew up pylons. We blew up the signal cables which enabled trains to run and thereby brought the trains to a standstill, blowing up pylons. We brought factories to a standstill. So it was economic targets we attacked to make our point to the government that their policies were unacceptable to us. Well, we had a fair run, 3 years. We were amateurs fighting professionals, and we eventually got arrested. Arrest, of course, means detention. Detention means you could be held for 90 days without anybody knowing where you are or that you were removed from society. And detention meant torture, interrogation, and detention also meant the death of a lot of people. Lots of people died whilst in detention. I was in detention initially for 3 months, interrogation. And then they again held me for a few days, but then my trial was coming up. During this period of time, I was asked by the security police to be state witness. One of my fellow detainees, Adrian Lefwich, who had a high profile compared to my profile, which was innocuous. And he had offered to be a state witness to the prosecution. But the security police wanted Adrian in the dock because he had a high profile figure. And he wanted me in the box because I was an innocuous person. Both Adrian and I were members of the National Executive of the African Resistance Movement. I declined to be state witness, and therefore Adrian was accepted. Just by the way, Adrian had written a book. I don't know any of you have access to the Gantzer Journal. He had written an article in the book, I've Named Names, and he emailed me and asked me if he could send me a copy and dedicate the article to me. I said, okay. I am meeting him sometime. Still have to make the appointment. He asked me to meet him. I'm meeting him to have lunch with him. This is 38 years ago, and his conscience is still torturing him. And even though many are against me going to have lunch with him, I felt that a little compassion would not be out of place. During the trial, I was found guilty, and I was sentenced to 15 years imprisonment, which I served on Robben Island. I had four fellow accused. My one fellow accused was charged with me for sabotage. He got 10 years, and the other three were charged furthering the aims of communism, which carried a lesser sentence. I went to Robben Island because blacks go to Robben Island, and my fellow accused went to Pretoria where whites were imprisoned. Whilst I was in prison, my fellow accused, who were white and had gone to Pretoria, their parents had appealed to the Nationalist Party government and said that their children had been led astray. Would it be possible for them to be released? The parents said they always voted Nationalist Party and they were loyal members of the Nationalist Party. Mr. Foster, who was Prime Minister at the time, acceded to their request, and all of them were released before the completion of their sentences. An outcry was then raised as to why am I still in jail and the others are released. Lawyers came to see me, parliamentarians came to see me, etc. I told them I'm not prepared to give any undertaking, and if they want to give me an exit permit, I'll accept it without conditions. Then that fell by the way. Then two judges came to see me in 1969. I went to jail in 1964. And Judge Groskopf and Judge Steyn, Supreme Court judges. And they told me that if I give an undertaking not to advocate or participate in violence against the African government, they would get me released. I declined to give that undertaking. I pointed out to them that if I give such an undertaking, I'll be sentencing my own children to slavery in the land of their birth. So I stayed. In 1971, Judge Steyn came on his own, and after pleading with me to give an undertaking, and again I declined, he said that even if I give him a verbal undertaking, he would accept it. I said, sorry, I can't. We shook hands and he left. So I completed my 15 years. Prison life was not all doom and gloom for me. I went to jail with a Standard 6 certificate, grade 8. And I came out of prison with 2 degrees, a BA and a BCom. Yes, I did. But I am indebted to my fellow prisoners who helped me to understand this new academic world which I was introduced to. And my very loyal brother, Norman, elder brother, who was loyal to me beyond the call of duty. But just a little side, a joke. When I was released from prison, the security police arrested me for breaking my banning orders. I had three five-year banning orders on me. But they were framing me, and because they twisted the facts, and they just wanted me to be imprisoned again. So on the, I was released in November, I was arrested in December. And I was then being interrogated at the police station, and my lawyer was with me. And there's one very bad chap. He was barking at me, questions, and I answered to the best of my ability what I thought he should know. And then he asked me, what are my academic qualifications? So I said, it's got nothing to do with this matter. He says to me, what are your academic qualifications? So my lawyer says, please, please answer him. So I answered him. I said, I got 2 degrees, a BA and a BCom. After the interrogation, I was released, and walking out, this security policeman, he confronted me, and he says, if I had your academic qualifications, I would write it on a piece of paper, paste it on my forehead, and walk around showing the public. So I told him, I says, you know, I haven't only got 2 degrees, I got 3 degrees. And my 3rd degree was my 1st degree, and that's what you people gave me. So prison life wasn't all doom and gloom. I received an education, grateful to my fellow prisoners for helping me and my brother. And I met wonderful people, people like Mr. Mandela, Mr. Sisulu, Mr. Kavarada, Mr. Mbeki, father of the President of South Africa. And that itself was an uplifting experience. We had hard times in jail. Poor food, blankets, 3 blankets. Which if I held it up in front of me, I would see you through the blanket. And the aim was to break us. The aim was to destroy us. The aim was to let the world forget about us. But under the leadership of Mr. Mandela and others, although I was not a member of the ANC, as I said, I was a member of the Liberal Party of South Africa, I was the only member of my organization on Robben Island. I was very lonely, but I was befriended by Mr. Mandela, the ANC, helped me to survive, and I'm grateful to them. Today, I am a member of the ANC. So prison life was hard, but organizations like the International Red Cross, Amnesty International, the Defense and Aid Fund, among others, all helped to contribute to easing our lot. And as time went by, after the 70s, things improved and prison life became much easier. But it became much easier because of world pressure. And world pressure emanated, first of all, the Defense and Aid Fund, 1955. That's a British organization. They were tremendous, tremendous. And we are so grateful to all of those organizations who helped us to survive, helped us to defeat apartheid. 2 short stories, and I'll be open to questions. This beautiful diamond which I discovered in Namibia, at that time, she was married. Her husband was a dear friend of mine. But when I realized that there was an attachment growing up between his wife and myself, I left Namibia. I then landed up in jail. Her husband, this beautiful diamond, he died in 1977. I was released in 1979. When I was released, Eleanor, that's the name, she read about my release and eventually found my telephone number and made contact. She wanted to join me in South Africa. She was a Scottish lady. I pleaded with her not to join me. I says, please don't join me. I'm a black man in a racialistic country. I have no job. I have no money. I have no future. I've got three five-year banning orders on me. Anybody who associates with me risks their future. So I said, please, please, stay away. We have been parted for a long time. Let us remember the good old days and leave it at that. She ignored my advice. I told her what a beautiful family she's got, beautiful children, valued friends, wonderful job. I says, you risk all of that to come and be with me. And she came to be with me. She was extremely courageous. She hadn't seen me for 20 years. I just come out of jail. And she came to join me. Nevertheless, when my banning orders were lifted, I told her we're not going to live like this, because I was living at the flat after my house arrest was lifted. And I said, we're going to get married. And we went to the minister of the church, and I said, we want to get married. I pointed out that if we are arrested, Ellen and I, the government, to justify its stance, apartheid stance, will say that our marriage was a shameful marriage, it was a disgraceful marriage, etc. And in fact, our marriage was, our love for each other was really beautiful. We really loved each other. And so we got married. We defied the Immorality Act. We defied the Mixed Marriage Act. But we survived. In spite of those who said we'll never survive, we survived. And 7 years later to the day, when these cruel laws were expunged from the statute book, we married again, legally this time. So we have two marriage certificates. The one in marriage certificates in my book, first one, which states that, among other things, that even if this unchristian government do not recognize your marriage, it's recognized in the eyes of God and church. Then finally, story about that great man we all know as Mr. Nelson Mandela. He's also called Madiba. That's his clan name. It's called the father of the nation. It's called many things. All gracious names, all names which are befitting to a man of his great stature. I was very ill one day on Robben Island, and we were not allowed to have access to the hospital. We were isolated. We were 30 people, and this was our universe. We were not allowed to meet anyone outside the water, outside our visitors, which were allowed occasionally to see us through a perspex. And we were had to look after ourselves when we were ill. Slept on the cement floor. So I was very ill that day, and Mr. Mandela came from work, working at the quarry, and he wanted to know where was Danny, what had happened to Danny, and he was told I was ill. And he came to my cell, the single cell I was in, and he came and tried to cheer me up. Mr. Mandela is a wonderful man. He will draw the good out of you, and he will emphasize it, and he'll play down any roles which perhaps may not be so glamorous. And he sat down there and he spoke to me and he encouraged me to get better. Then he went back to his cell. He was locked up in his cell. I was locked up in mine. The next morning, Mr. Mandela came to my cell. Now, we did not have waterborne sewage in our cells. We had a bucket. And he came into my cell carrying his bucket on his arm, put it down, sat down next to me on the floor, and again encouraged me to get better. Then he got up, picked up his bucket, picked up my bucket on his other arm, went to the common toilet, emptied the contents, cleaned my bucket, his of course, and he brought my bucket back to my cell. Now, to put the story into context, Mr. Mandela was the leader of the most powerful organization, the ANC, which was opposed to the government. He was also the leader of the majority group on Robben Island. He could have instructed anyone to look after me. Mr. Mandela was also an international figure. I was nothing. I was the only person of my organization on Robben Island. I had no political muscle. Still, Mr. Mandela came down to my level in more ways than one, and he assisted me. Mr. Mandela is a wonderful man. He's a great, magnanimous person. Thank you.
We're going to go into a time of questions now, but just before we do that, I just wanted to say that tomorrow in Eddie's interview, we're going to be looking particularly into issues of the struggle against apartheid, so an in-depth look at that, as well as life on Robben Island, and insights into people like Mr. Mandela and Mr. Sisulu and others, and also into the idea of non-racialism, which Eddie is a proponent of. So do come along to that and to get a real in-depth look at Eddie's time in South Africa. But also feel free in question time to ask questions on any of those subjects or any other subject. Eddie has told me that he doesn't mind answering questions on absolutely anything, so feel free. So does anyone have any questions? We have a question at the back here, so I'm going to be the roving mic. I'm a little slow because I broke my leg recently. Well, not that recently.
Hi. My mum's Nigerian, but I've got white skin. So how would I be treated if I was in South Africa when you were?
Oh, I didn't follow it. Okay.
Sorry. My mother is Nigerian, and I've got white skin. So how would I be treated? How would I have been treated?
Well, officially, government policy, you would be a so-called coloured person. Because supposed to have mixed blood in you. I say so-called because that was a title, a classification imposed by the government on people of, well, I claim my ancestors were slaves and colonialists, so I derived my genes worldwide. So you were then, as I say, be classified as a so-called a coloured person, you see? And this was the government's policy of divide and rule, oppose groups. There are some people in South Africa who claim they are coloured, you see? But that's their choice. I reject it. I'm black. I'm a black South African. And even though I could have been a white South African if I wished, because at the time of the racial classification, people who were like myself, marginal, from a marginal family, had the choice. Members of my family are white. Members of my family are black. I'm one of them. Thank you.
More questions? One over here. Oh, one over here, and then I'll come over to the back.
Okay, thank you. It's a real privilege to hear you talk today. I have a question. It's sort of slightly sort of in parallel, I guess, to what you've been talking about. I see another situation of great injustice developing in Southern Africa at the moment in your neighbouring country, Zimbabwe, very current at the moment. From your experience and obviously your knowledge of the politics, the situation out there, how can you advise us today to get involved in making a difference to see the injustice turned around in Zimbabwe?
Well, the world made a wonderful contribution to in defeating apartheid through pressure groups. And we in South Africa, and I speak from most of the attitudes of people which I get via the press, whatever, are deeply disappointed in Mr. Robert Mugabe in Zimbabwe. We feel that his rule of Zimbabwe at the moment is endangering the peaceful development of all of Southern Africa. There's a threatened famine, or perhaps the famine is there already. But he has exacerbated the situation. And we in South Africa, we also feel the effects of that, because more and more refugees are coming into South Africa. More and more pressure is being put on our infrastructures, hospitals, roads, whatever. And we would like Mr. Mugabe to change his policies. And what we are trying to do in South Africa, maybe some people consider it's not enough or adequate, But we are trying to apply pressure through persuasion, perhaps later maybe stronger pressure through denying him access to certain things, hopefully. But I support your point, and I would appeal to the world, as we appeal to the world, when apartheid was in South Africa, that world pressure does help, and we trust that it will persuade Mr. Mugabe to have a more liberal approach to his country. Okay.
We have another question over here.
Hi. When you started protesting against the unjust situation in South Africa, you started off with peaceful means. When that didn't work, you moved on to more violent means, but drew the line by trying to avoid hurting people, just buildings. At what point do you think, if that hadn't worked, you might have moved on to further things? Because I'm interested to hear your point of view on what gets labelled as terrorism in other parts of the world. How do you think people can justify what they do, and how far can you go?
Well, I suppose each to his own. We were hitting economic targets, and we felt that if we were successful in crippling the country economically, we would make progress. In South Africa, violence did take place. People did die. One of the members of my organization had planted a bomb on Johannesburg Station. I was in detention at the time. It was to protest against the government policies, etc. He phoned the newspapers, he phoned the police, and he said, there's a bomb on the station, please clear the concourse. They did not do so. A woman was killed. My friend was hung. So a lot depends on how the struggle develops. And we took up violence, and I did not expect to see the end of apartheid. I did not expect to survive Robben Island. But it was just that I felt it was my duty to continue fighting. Whether I would have gone beyond that at a later stage if the situation became more desperate, I do not know. But that was our policies at that particular stage. People who deliberately go forward and take life, I don't know what drives them. Some people are driven by religion. Other people are driven by the call of duty. But I suppose each one of us will assess the situation as it applies to them. I am against killing. I'm against death. I'm against violence. But at times, one feels, and not necessarily we were right, but one feels that one may have to apply a bit more pressure in some form or other to bring about some form of change. Thank you.
You may remember that Eddie was talking about the time when the security forces were trying to turn him to a state witness. Now, at that time, it was when his colleague set the bomb off in Johannesburg Station. And so the security forces actually came back to Eddie and said, well, you know that your friend is going to hang now. And do you know that for your actions now, because you're associated with this organization, you may well now get the death penalty? And Eddie still refused to turn state witness and still maintained his line, which is most admirable. Any other questions? We have a question down here.
Yeah, I just wanted to know, you were talking about international pressure being so important. Do you think that trade sanctions is a good way of applying international pressure? Do you think sanctions is a good way of applying pressure, or does it just hit the poorest people?
Thank you. Yes, in relation to the former question, when I was arrested and all my colleagues, we faced the death penalty immediately because the mere fact of having explosives carried the death penalty. So the death penalty was there throughout, but it became far more threatening after the bomb explosion on the station. The question here is, do I think sanctions is effective or was effective? I can assure you it was very effective, really. That is why we are indebted to the world when the world applied sanctions to South Africa. Now, the argument was, and as the young lady there rightly stated, that there was one side of the argument was that if you have sanctions, you are going to hurt the poorest of the poor so much more. They are already suffering, and you're going to increase their suffering. The other argument, of which I was in favor of, is we are already suffering. We'll continue to suffer. Now we're suffering for even a greater purpose, a greater reason. And ladies and gentlemen, I often take people to the Robben Island, show them around the cells, etc., and give them a bit of history of the struggle. And in those early days when sanctions was applied, to see the Cape Town docks with no ships, to see no ships lying in the bay, knowing that the economy of South Africa was being hit, it was a joy, really, to us. Of course, the sanctions was effective. And now when I take people to Robben Island and I stand going on the ferry across the Robben Island and I see ships in the docks and I see ships lying in the bay waiting to be docked, I feel good. The economy is developing and prospering. And it was only because of sanctions helping us to defeat apartheid which enabled us now once again to have a prosperous economy. So sanctions was very effective. Thank you.
More questions? The back.
I wondered how you got over all the terrible suffering and pain that you experienced and your friends experienced, and you come out not bitter. That seems to be the pattern. I'd like to know how you endure that, you know, the memories, the
Thank
bad
you.
Memories.
Thank you. I personally have no bitterness to anyone. I embrace those who tortured me. Revenge is petty, short-sighted. My country is more important. I want to build up my country. We never had counseling. When we left prison, we were just thrown out of prison and we had to find our own way. One of the ways I discovered later, I did not realize it at the time, I discovered later was that because I spoke about my imprisonment, and I spoke about my time under detention, which was rather bad. It kind of eased me and cleansed me and made me feel so better, just a mere fact of speaking. But then there were also other consolations, of course, is that we won the war. And my norms and my values had triumphed. So that, of course, perhaps also a helping factor. But I'd also like to point out that I was very fortunate. I landed on my feet. I had a home to go to. Others who left prison, they had no homes to go to. When you're sentenced to 10 years and 15 years and 20 years, you're not expected to come out alive. And so wives who've got to rear children, people who are very, very, very poor, whose neighbors are poor, and they can't expect help from their neighbors whose husbands are in jail or whose sons are in exile, they must raise their children. And what do? They take another man out of sheer necessity. And when the husband survives and they come out of jail, well, there's no home, you know. And others' homes are gone, been blown up or bulldozed. And I was one of those fortunate people. Others were not so fortunate. But I bear no bitterness to anybody. As I told you, the man who gave evidence against me, I'm going to meet him. And I'll say hello to him.
Any other questions? While I was talking to Eddie yesterday, I asked him, what How did he keep his mind sane during that time? You know, what did you think about when you were cooped up in the cell for you know, many hours a day? And Eddie told me about the one thing that was on his mind constantly throughout was trying to escape. So Eddie, I wonder if you could tell us a little bit about your escape plans.
Well, ladies and gentlemen, from day one I tried to escape. That's one thing that really kept me going. And when I was awaiting trial at Paulsmoor Prison, I was with four others in a huge cell about the size from that doorway to the end, huge cell, which usually accommodates 60 to 80 prisoners, but there were only five of us in the cell. And I had earlier tried to bribe a warder when I was in detention, and I promised him a lot of money. I said my brother's got my power of attorney, and he would allow me, and my fellow detainee was held downstairs, I was held upstairs. He would allow us to take a walk on the block. I'll ensure that he gets a lot of money. But he said he couldn't take the risk after long, long, long hesitation. But now I was at Paulsmoor Prison, and this warder passed, and I spoke to him, and I asked him if he would be prepared to assist me in getting out of prison. I offered him 2,000 rand if he would give me some axe blades, and he agreed. I felt quite ashamed of myself at the time because I never had 2,000 rand. And when he came around again on his rounds, I called him over. His name was MacDillan. I do not know at the time, but I found out later. And I called him over and I says, excuse me, I says, I haven't got 2,000. Will 200 be all right? And he says, yes. So he gave me some axe blades and we sawed through the bars. And we were supposed to go out the Wednesday night. Tuesday, we tried out the blades to see how long we take to cut through the bars. And we cut through the one section and left the bar hanging there on a thin thread just to be yanked out. And we decided to do the next bar the next day because we could time ourselves. But unfortunately for us, next morning, the cell opposite us was full of prisoners, and we realized they would see us sawing through the bar. And but we had to go ahead because we were supposed to go out that evening. So we sawed through the bar, and then MacDillan came along the evening and said the escape is off. The escape car is not available, or the pickup car is not available. Something had gone wrong somewhere, so we couldn't get out. We had to abandon the escape. One of the prisoners opposite us, reported us to the authorities, and that gave me an extra 3 months in isolation. MacDillan himself was arrested because he was also helping common law prisoners to escape, and they gave evidence against him. He got 3 years, and of course the escape was abandoned. I tried many other ways, but our security was very tight. The lights were on in our cells all night. We were counted regularly, and I said if I get 10 hours start, I would give it a go. But my big effort was in 76 when I realized that when I decided, well, it's no good me trying anymore. I've got 3 years to go. I might as well stick it out. Then at that time, there was trouble at the Suez Canal, and big oil tankers were coming around the tip of Southern Africa. And I saw these helicopters coming over the island. They first were banned from the island, but familiarity breeds contempt. And as time went by, the helicopters came nearer and nearer because it was a shortcut over the island. And then I realized there was a possibility of rescuing Mr. Mandela from the island. And I then worked out a scheme. I said, I would rescue Mr. Mandela. I spoke to Mr. Mandela about it. And he agreed that the scheme was plausible. I gave it an 80-20 success chance. Ms. Mandela spoke to the ANC on Robben Island to get the agreement, because one of the points he made is that we are revolutionaries. It is our duty to try and escape from the clutches of the enemy. The ANC committee on Robben Island sanctioned the plan, and I would have to meet Mr. Oliver Tambo, who was leader in exile at ANC when I get out of prison, and discuss the plan with the ANC itself. I could not meet Mr. Tambo when I got out of prison because I was under house arrest. And to put the plan in operation, I had to be in the country because I had to be part of the plan. The plan was that because the island was geared to a sea escape, that they would not anticipate an escape where we escape from the island and we go back to the mainland. I and the pilot would come over with a helicopter. It would be on the New Year's morning, 1981, at 9:15. 9 o'clock, there are visitors coming to the island. 9 o'clock, we are shown a film. And if we don't like the film, we are allowed to walk out into the yard. And Ms. Mandela was going to walk out into the yard from the film. It's also New Year's Day morning when all the warders are still tired from the night before, not very alert. And we felt this is a good and best time to strike. So I was coming over with a helicopter because I knew the terrain and I wanted to be part of this project. We would have a basket under the helicopter, and the basket would be decorated with the old South African flag and decorations so that we could allay suspicion. There'd be a winch inside the helicopter. We would lower the basket from the belly of the helicopter with the winch into the yard, and Mr. Mandela would roll into the basket. We'd winch him up, and then we'd go back to the mainland. We banked on the fact that, point one, when the siren goes off, they would rush to stations which would prevent the sea escape and give us those extra minutes, seconds of grace. And the other is that because we had this decorated basket, the authorities would not be sure whether it was a prank being played because it's New Year's Day, etc., and whether it's just a big jest. And therefore, when they see us going back to the mainland, they would hesitate to shoot, not knowing really what was taking place. But being confident of the fact, they would radio ahead, and when we land, they would arrest us. The idea, of course, we are going to land, but not just any place. We were going to land in a friendly embassy and then ask for political asylum. That was the plan. And I called it my two-step plan because a couple of years later, during a dark, stormy night, I'd rescue Mr. Mandela from the embassy and take him over. I'd also be with Mr. Mandela in the embassy and take him abroad. The plan didn't come to fruition. I got the plan through to England. I've got in my file at home. As a matter of fact, all the newspapers got hold of the plan subsequently and made quite a big thing of it. But I sent the plan via a friend to the ANC in London, and then this plan went to Lusaka. And whilst the plan and other aspects were under consideration, news came through that the South African army was going to attack Lusaka. And the orders were that all documents should be destroyed. And then a lady by the name of Mrs. Connie Braam from the Dutch anti-apartheid organization said she's taking that document. She rescued my plan and took it with her to Holland. And when the museum was founded, the Robben Island Museum, she sent my plans back to the museum, and now it is displayed there. It was a plan which did not come to fruition, but it was one of my little attempts of trying to escape from the clutches of the enemy. I was out, but I wanted to rescue Mr. Mandela as well, so it didn't work out.
It's of time now, but we have another question at the front. We have time for one or two.
Oh,
more.
A young lady.
What food did they give you to eat?
Okay, what a lovely question. Thank you very much. The food they gave us was dirty, very little. When I was first imprisoned, among my rations was a mug of soup. The soup stank. It stank. My stomach just turned, really. And for the next 7 days, 10 days, I threw the soup in my bucket. But after that, if they did not give me my soup, I complained. One wants to survive, and you survive under the most brutal circumstances. As I say, the food was dirty. The food was little. In our section, there were only 30 of us. That was our universe. We were not assaulted with the batons. Outside our section, people were assaulted. We were starved. We were persecuted in other ways. They wanted to destroy us in other ways. Possibly because of the presence of Mr. Mandela there. We were not just around the corner from us, our wing around the corner. They'd beat people unconscious, and we'd hear the screams, etc. But we were not brutally assaulted in that manner. But we were starved, a little food, dirty food. I'll tell you a little incident about food, because of the graciousness of this young lady here. The warders and some political prisoners who cooperated with the warders, they were stealing our food, which made our food even less. Some people were very antagonistic to these people who stole the food. But what they would do, they'd get the plates. We had tin plates. They would fill it with meat with a cover of porridge. And they would pretend it's a plate of porridge. In the meantime, it was a plate of meat. And one of the fellow prisoners, Johnson Mlambo, a very good chap, because he was a black intellectual, he was very badly persecuted on the island. But he challenged some of these prisoners with his plates of supposed to be porridge. And he said, "I want to see what's in there." And they refused to show him. And they fought. And he took his eye out. And he had to be rushed to Cape Town. Well, they saved his life. But that was also due to the fact that people, in this case, they were stealing our food. But our food wasn't very appetizing. But as time went by again, after the 70s, due to the International Red Cross, Amnesty International, and others, our food improved. Our blankets improved. We were allowed to study. That's where I got my degrees. And we were allowed recreational facilities, Scrabble, chess, etc. So as time went by, prison life actually became a bit easier. Thank you, young lady. Thank you.
Well, it's been fantastic, Eddie, to hear of your triumph, of the triumph of the human spirit over brutality. Now, please, as I mentioned earlier, do come along to hear more about Eddie's extraordinary life in South Africa, and that is tomorrow at, what do we say, 1 o'clock in Snog as well. But please give a round of applause to Comrade Eddie Daniels. And of course, there's the book signing in the bookshop in about half an hour at 6 o'clock, and it's Eddie's book, Robben Island, There and Back. It's a fantastic read, so...